Turn your Bibles to 1 Peter. 1 Peter will be the first passage we'll read from here in just a moment. We've been working our way through 1 Timothy in general over a couple of Sunday nights. And we've come to a section that may not always get a lengthy treatment. And so while we're only going to cover two verses, I think it's a subject worthy of our attention to help prepare ourselves for talking about this subject with those who may have good, honest, sincere questions. We have looked at, in chapter 5 of 1 Timothy, honoring age groups, honoring those who are truly widows indeed. That's Paul's wording there. We've called it honor real widows here on the screen. And then honor the elders, verses 17 through 25. So we come to chapter 6, and there's going to be a new subject to honor, and this is honor your masters. And so, of course, that raises the issue of slavery. Usually when I've come to a passage in the New Testament on slavery, I've jumped right to applying it to the workplace. And I think there's an appropriate time and place to discuss how our workplace scenarios have some parallels to the slavery scenarios and some of the principles that we're told to do. But this time I want us to, as I said, elaborate here to speak a little bit in detail about slavery. The slavery that is commonly depicted as American slavery in the American South is a sinful type, kind of a sinful slavery. Judging the accuracy of the commonly depicted or the common depictions of that slavery can fall to the historians. If you aren't aware, there are historians that debate about exactly to what extent certain things happen, but that's not our concern here this evening. It's just in a large scale way, American slavery was sinful. But the slavery we're talking about here in the Bible will be a very different subject. And so this raises two common mistakes that we need to be aware of when talking about slavery, slavery in the Bible specifically. First of all, what some people have called chronological snobbery. This idea is that if mankind is constantly making progress, then ancient men who lived before were behind the times. They were more ignorant, and that is not just maybe in the moral realm, but also in the mathematical realm. Some would think this about them. It reminds me of a time in the film National Treasure, where there was a man who marveled at the architecture of the ancient world, and the good guy responds, well, how do you think they built the pyramids? Because the fact remains that scientists can't agree on how it's puzzling. Of course, I prefer the theorist who points at the graves of the Jewish slaves of Egypt and says that it was built on the backs of these slaves. Now, my point is this. We can't even explain how they had the machinery for building these pyramids. So obviously they aren't as dumb as we think they were about engineering and physics and math. And so perhaps even in some of their morals, they may have a better grasp on the reality of how life works, even if they were engaged in certain immoral things. So be careful about chronological snobbery, thinking that the ancients who did all this were dumb. And the other mistake would be an anachronism. This is where you place objects in the wrong time period. If I said a crane was lowering the block into place, what comes to your mind? You don't have to answer out loud. Just when you think about a crane lowering the block into place. But now it depends on if I change it. If I say a crane lowering a block into place in the 400s AD or the 1200s AD or the 1800s or even 2019. As I change the year, those of you who are experts in crane technology, the image changed. The rest of you are saying, oh, I don't know the difference between a 1200s crane and a 400s. But there is. There's a difference. And we understand this, and so you have to be careful about making sure you're getting the right time period of the thing that you are talking about. And these mistakes are important today for correctly looking at 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 through 2. It is a mistake to automatically assume that we're smarter than the ancients, even in our morals. And similarly, we don't want to assume that American slavery was the same as this ancient slavery that Paul's addressing here. Now, I do need to be clear about this Greco-Roman slavery that is not American. Legal ownership of humans and them being considered property was long accepted in the history of civilizations. It is only since the Enlightenment here in the West that it's been rejected as immoral. And so in many parts of the world, even still to this day, that are not part of Western civilization, they don't have the moral hang-ups about slavery that we do. I'm not saying they're right and we're wrong. I'm just trying to broaden our perspective about how civilizations view certain things from the ancient world even down to today. That's not meant to be an endorsement of this slavery, the people of property. But this is important to help us be able to understand and be able to answer when people ask us about why. When we ask about why on certain things, this might help us give out our answer, give a defense of the faith, and be able to live out our faith. So here's what Greco-Roman slavery of that time was like. It was not racial. They did allow education of the slaves. In fact, it was encouraged that slaves were educated. And slaves were given a big responsibility. In fact, some slaves had delegated authority over free men. That may be the first time I read that one, that was really hard for me to even follow how that could happen. But if you can follow this, there was a free man who needed some work to do. And a man's slave had the ability, the authority to hire that free man to help get the work done on the land that was owned by the master. So the slaves had a lot of responsibility. They were often very well financially cared for, unlike the free men. The free men of the ancient world were in worse situations, worse conditions, living conditions, than the slave. Because the slave, that property needed to be cared for and not allow it to go destitute, whereas the free man, he was scrounging around for a daily meal in a way that the slave did not have to worry in the same way. So this happened so much so that free men often sold themselves into slavery. So one of the ways that is different from American slavery is that it was often, if not always, voluntary. You can't say always, but just it's more often than we sometimes give it credit for. Slaves could also own property, and so some slaves actually owned their own slaves in the ancient Greco-Roman system of slavery. It was very common, but very rarely viewed as a permanent status. In fact, the Roman governor Felix, that you read about in Acts chapter 23 through 25, Felix was a former slave. Think about that. You could go from a slave to being a governor in the ancient world. Antonia, the emperor Claudius's mother, had freed him and his brother. And there are philosophers, even Epictetus, who raised in slavery. And in all of his philosophical works, he never questions slavery. So you have an ancient philosopher that actually raises a slave, never questions whether or not it's moral. And so you come to someone like the famous philosopher, Jewish man, Philo. This was a summary actually about ancient slavery, where it says, for the famous philosopher Jew, Philo, a person's achieving inner freedom from domination by social conventions, life's circumstances, and one's passions was far more important than any change in one's social legal status. So this brings us to our first application. You may be saying, I didn't want to come hear a history lecture on the ancient Greco-Roman world about slavery. I need something to motivate me for today. Listen, this is really touching. It's kind of wordy where he missed it here, but he's saying it is more important that you have inner freedom and not feel dominated by life circumstances. Don't feel dominated by your passions. That's what's more important. And he's touching here on a type of slavery that some of us are trapped with today. And so here's the important lesson. Some of us aren't even aware of the fact that we feel subconsciously enslaved to fate. You feel enslaved to fate. How many of us have said, it is what it is? That can be a form of fatalism. A deadly, distracting mistake to assume that things are inevitable. Look at, I actually told you we'd read from 1 Peter and I made a mistake. Let me flip back to 2 Chronicles. You don't have to flip over there. If you want to keep your place. But 2 Chronicles, we'll read this real quick. In chapter 20, listen to the defeat of fatalism here in this story. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 15, this is here, we'll start reading verse 14. Then in the midst of the assembly, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jael, the son of Mattaniah, the Levite, of the sons of Asaph. And he said, listen, all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and King Jehoshaphat, thus says Jehovah to you, do not fear or be dismayed because of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go down against them, and behold, they will come up by the ascent of Ziz, and you will find them at the end of the valley in front of the wilderness of Jeruel, and you need not fight in this battle. Station yourselves, stand and see the salvation of Jehovah on your behalf. This passage here in 2 Chronicles 20 talks about this idea of fatalism. There's nothing we can do. That's how Jehoshaphat and the rest of them felt. They said, there's nothing we can do. We're going to be destroyed. They had forgotten that God was in control. They were taking an attitude of, it is what it is. We're going to die. And had forgotten this most important point. This is a, I don't think this person was the originator of this quote, but I've always liked this change of the quote, and now I found that Pat Summitt got the credit, so she can get it, I guess. That'll make Ryan Watson happy, wherever he's gotten off to. It is what it is, but it will be what you make it. And what we Christians need to understand with this quote is, it'll be what we make it with God's help. Don't be a slave to fatalism. Don't let life's circumstances have you so dominated that you feel trapped and that there's nothing you can do. Because with God on our side, there is always something that He can do with us working with Him to overcome many of the adversities that Satan has put in our way. So I hope that overview there adequately shows the slavery that Paul has in mind. There are several New Testament passages about slavery. And so the first one that we were going to read earlier, and we now will read that in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18. These are not easy passages. It says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in His steps." The New Testament repeatedly shows an expectation of slaves that is very challenging. If you are a slave and you have a master who's acting unreasonable, bear up underneath that unreasonable master. That's what Peter's saying to do. And like I said, I usually jump to the workplace and we talk about how many of us have had bosses. We feel like the boss is unreasonable. We might feel like the system's unreasonable. You mean to tell me that I got to work that shift for 5 years before I can have the good shift? Yeah, that's what we mean to tell you. And there may be no reason for it at all, but you suffer underneath that because you're thankful to be able to have the opportunity to have the blessings to take care of your family and share with others. But in our society, we've become so demanding about trying to have the picture-perfect job where there is no trouble. That's an unrealistic view of life. And so these passages really not just challenge slavery in the ancient world, but they can also challenge us today. I think the closest that I know of that Paul ever gets to saying that you should be getting out of slavery, being against slavery, is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 19 through 24. It's 1 Corinthians 7, verse 19 through 24. It says, "Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Each man must remain in what condition? In that condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called." This is the closest I know of Paul saying that it's desirable to free yourself. But even in this, he really says not to worry about it. And to make sure that most importantly, you're pleasing to God and not just trying to be pleasing to men. So there's a passage, again, that's challenging. There's 8 other passages we can look at. We're not going to look at all of these. And in these passages, masters are commanded to treat their slaves well. So here's another part of slavery in the New Testament that we've got to think about. Not only do we not find the slaves being told what we wish they were told, in some cases. We wish Paul were saying, you need to get free. But to the masters, he's not telling those who are Christian masters to release all your slaves like we might want for him to tell. But he is saying something that was very countercultural. He is saying, masters, you need to treat your slaves better than the rest of the world treats their slaves. And he tells both of them in Colossians chapter 3 that you need to keep your focus on God when you do these things. In Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 22, we have this other passage here. "Slaves in all things," this is Colossians 3:22. "Obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, do your work heartily, as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. For he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality. Masters, grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven." And so Paul tells both of them they need to stay focused on God. You do see in the New Testament that it was wrong to force someone into slavery. Kidnapping was wrong. That's in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10. It doesn't look like that made it on the screen, so make sure to say it again. 1 Timothy 1, 10, this idea of kidnapping wrong. You see it also in Revelation. I don't remember the chapter and verse right offhand, but there were souls that were being transported. There was human trafficking in the symbol of the city of Babylon, whoever that's symbolic for. But in that day, here's something that surprised me as well, is voluntary slavery was preferred to death. The beloved motto of New Hampshire that probably wouldn't find a lot of agreement even here in Texas, live free or die, was not the way that the Bible talks about things. Voluntary slavery there was preferred to death. They would rather be enslaved and alive than free and die in the ancient world, and I think also in Scripture. Now, what Paul does believe is he believes that repayments of debts is necessary. This is Philemon, verse 18. If he has wronged you in any way or owes you anything, charge that to my account and I'll repay it. This is an important part of ancient slavery, paying off debts. This is often why a person ended up in slavery. They volunteered for slavery to pay off money that was owed to somebody. And so again, while we may be thinking, well, this is all very academic and historical, here's the application for us. This is the slavery that many of us today are in. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7 warns, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. We may not talk about it that way. We may not feel enslaved in that sense, but there's a sense in which if you borrowed from American Express, you're a slave for American Express or MasterCard or Visa or fill in the blank with whatever you want. Because you know that if you don't pay back, they're going to come knocking on the door. Where's our money? And so there's a sense in which the more you become indebted to those companies, whoever they are, the more you owe those companies, the more you're working to pay them off rather than working to be able to have the money for yourselves. And so we may not like it, but if we owe this money or even the taxes, we can say the same thing. We're slaves. Now, there used to be debtors' prisons. And while debtors' prisons may not be coming back anytime soon, there are still consequences that will hit you. And so this is why it's important for us to talk about issues of ancient slavery, since a lot of slavery was involved with debt. It's an important warning for us to be careful about the debts we get ourselves in, because there will be consequences that hurt. And it's foolish for us to never warn our children about that or to warn our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ about the consequences of that kind of figurative slavery that still exists today. And so then we come to chapter 6 of 1 Timothy, which actually is connected with this issue of finance. The whole reason I ended on that note is because think back to what the context has been. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and 6, like we've been talking about, those who are here, you notice it was about financial assistance to widows, those who were truly widows, and there was also financial assistance to hardworking elders. So when you talk about that, use of the church money, as we did in chapter 5, we went through there here, it brings up an interesting question. Let's read 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. All who are under the yoke as slaves are to regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and our doctrine will not be spoken against. Those who have believers as their masters must not be disrespectful to them because they are brethren, but must serve them all the more because those who partake of the benefit are believers and beloved. Teach and preach these principles. There's a lot to think about with this. If you have a believer who is your master. Again, we have this passage where we may be, in our modern context, coming to it expecting Paul to say, hey, if you're a believer who's a master and you have believing slaves, free them. But that's not what he says. But to properly analyze this text, we need to keep this in mind about this context. Paul here says nothing of using church funds to liberate slaves. And so as I read, why did Paul go this direction with chapter 6, verse 1? How did he go from, you know, providing financial aid to the widows, providing financial aid to the hardworking elder, and then all of a sudden he makes this shift here to masters and slaves? I read, why did he make that shift? This isn't a dogmatic answer, but one guy suggested, and I think it's a good idea, money is on his mind because some have asked, should we use money to liberate some of the Christian slaves? The same way they asked about, should we use money to pay for widows? And Paul gives the answer. Should we use money to pay some of our elders? And Paul gives his answer. He's now answering the question about liberating slaves in this way. Now, if that was all the evidence we had, I think that might be somewhat of a leap. But the early church writings are clear about not supporting this. An early church writer named Polycarp, he asked about, what about the church paying to free slaves? And Ignatius responds, let not slaves be puffed up, but let them serve the more faithfully to the glory of God, that they may obtain a better freedom from God, and let them not desire to be set free at the public cost, lest they be found slaves of lust. This sounds a lot like what happened with the widows. Be careful not to give money to widows who aren't widows truly indeed, because they might be given over to worldly pleasures. So Ignatius there using Timothy, the wording of Timothy, to apply also to the issue of slavery. Now this may sound harsh, especially if you have the wrong kind of slavery in mind. This sounds really harsh. So remember what we said at the beginning. We're not talking about American form of slavery. But if you're talking about American form of slavery, this would sound very harsh. Even if you view it with the ancient slavery in mind, I know that this sounds harsh to some. But perhaps our disgust at this stems from our culture and not from Scripture. So, for example, what would we do if captive slavery makes a comeback? If there were people to rise up and allow captive slavery to become dominant again in the civilization that we live in, will we enslave ourselves to feed our family? If that was the only way for you to get food for your family, would you be too proud to be a slave to get the food? Or would you love your family enough to volunteer for slavery as some of the early Christians did? If Muslims were to take captive some parts of the Western world, Muslims have no problem with slavery. So in that condition, would we, underneath Muslim world, would we glorify Jesus over Muhammad by being slaves who show a good example of the light and the darkness? Now, these are hypothetical questions for us, but let's keep this in mind. There are Christians in some parts of the world today who these are not hypothetical questions. These are the only options left on the table. So one more reason to preach and teach these principles, as Paul told Timothy to do, is this. I read these passages and it makes me so thankful to God for how good he's allowed me to have it. It reminds me not to abuse that good for evil. Don't use my freedom for lust. It reminds me that I have brothers and sisters who, when they read these passages, it means something so much more real to them than it does me. It allows me to have gratitude for what I've been given. And I hope that it reminds all of us gathered here to be grateful for what we've been given. And it challenges us to think about how we teach Christianity. Are we teaching a Christianity that only works in the free West? Or are we teaching a Christianity that is really based on the New Testament text? So Paul asserts that even in the case of two believers, that the two believers must submit to authority, because insubordination would not only serve to slander God and not honor him. And God was very concerned that God not be slandered. And so he regularly tells the Christians to submit to authority, and he does tell them to care about how it appears to men. I know sometimes the spirit of our culture says, don't worry what others think about you. But Paul actually does, he's concerned about what others think. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 21, we have regard for what is honorable, not only in the sight of God, but also the sight of men. Paul cared what people thought. He wanted people to think well of the doctrine of God. And so to encourage any kind of insubordination would allow people to then think, oh, this religion that Paul is teaching is a bad idea because it's going to lead to complete revolt, an uproar, as people challenge the structures of society. So Paul had no problem saying you stay in that position of authority and submission to the authority. Paul was not interested in social reform or a slave rebellion. He was interested in what did people think about God's name. Did they say those Christians are good people? Or did they say those Christians are troublesome people? And even though we don't have slavery today, because of the way that we behave, people may see us more as troublesome than they do good. So let us be sure to think about how we have new areas in which we may need to think about what we plead for when it comes to social reform and types of political rebellion. And so I would suggest to you that Paul's approach is still needed today. Being equals in Christ doesn't remove authority structures. We still must learn to submit to the authorities. And if you can't do this, you won't have a job. So we need to humbly submit. And we need to teach this to our children. We need to teach this to our fellow saints, that we need to be people who are eager to work. And once we have the job, we're eager to please the bosses, and that we are thankful for this opportunity to live in a culture which has put so much regulation in such a way that we are well cared for in those positions. And so it may be uncomfortable for us, but the New Testament speaks clearly about slavery. And I think it's important for us to understand this, because as we've made clear here, and there's a sense in which we're all slaves. It's clear from the scriptures, a famous passage in Luke chapter 19, 11 through 27, and again in chapter 22, verses 24 through 27, slavery is a metaphor for God's people. It's not a new metaphor used by Jesus. It's been going on all the way back with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, and David, and Job. They're all called slaves of Yahweh, or servants of Yahweh, depending on your translation. The word there is slave, but sometimes we've softened it to say servant of Jehovah instead of slave of Jehovah. But in Jesus' great parable in Luke 19, we referred to earlier, when he talks about entering into the kingdom, he has God say, "Well done, good and faithful slave." So if you don't like being called a slave, you might be signed up for the wrong family, the wrong kingdom, the wrong church. Because the New Testament says we are to be good slaves of God our Father. He's a good and faithful master. And if we don't wrestle with the slave text of the New Testament, we may not have the well-rounded faith that he wants us to have. We need to be able to teach and preach about the slavery passages that come up from time to time throughout. And so I hope that in some way this lesson this evening helped you rethink about some of these slavery passages. So as we do at the end of every lesson, we have a song that we're about to sing in which we will invite those who need to respond publicly to the Lord's invitation to be one of his people or to ask for the prayers of the congregation. We'll invite those to come forward during this song. And I know that there may be many who don't have a need for a public response here this evening. But that as you sing this song, I hope you'll be able to think about what it is that you can do to make your slavery to God a good and faithful slavery, as described there in Jesus' parable about entering the kingdom. But if you are one of those who needs to respond publicly, if you've never been buried in the waters of death and raised again in newness of life, we would encourage you during this song to come forward and let us know about your desire for that so that we can talk with you about the serious commitment of that. Or if you need the prayers of the congregation, you too can use this time to let that be known. Would you join with me as we stand and sing?